Okay. So, Leviticus 8 through 10. I hope everybody did the homework. So I kind of was looking through chapter 8, and I want to start with verse 4. Leviticus 8, verse 4 says, "So Moses did as the Lord commanded him, and the congregation was gathered together at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And Moses said to the congregation, 'This is what the Lord commanded to be done.'" So, talking about obedience. God commanded it. Moses did it. And he even told them that he did it. Why? Because the Lord commanded it, right? So you see that same kind of wording, as the Lord has commanded Moses, in verse 9, in verse 13, 17, 21, 29, 31, and in the last three verses of this chapter on 34, 35, and 36. 34 says, "And as he has done this day, so the Lord has commanded to do, to make atonement for you. Therefore you shall stay at the door of the tabernacle meeting day and night for 7 days and keep the charge of the Lord so that you may not die, for so I have been commanded." So Aaron and his sons did all the things that the Lord had commanded by the hand of Moses. So 7 days to consecrate the priests and all that was commanded. So Moses and Aaron and the congregation, the people, the Israelites, were being obedient by doing what the Lord says. Of course, this continues in Leviticus 9, verse 5, 6, and 7 all have the same kind of language that what Moses commanded, what commandments came from the Lord. The Lord commanded Moses, as the Lord commanded. Also in verses 10 and 20, as the Lord had commanded Moses, as the Lord had commanded. So we're getting a lot of this, the same idea that the Lord commands it, they obey it, right? Which brings us up to the end of chapter 9, where we have this miracle. It is a miracle. Verse 23, we'll start in. "And Moses and Aaron went into the tabernacle meeting and came out and blessed the people. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat on the altar. When all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces." So the glory of the Lord appearing to all the people was a promise that was made back in verse 4. Chapter 9, verse 4 says, "Also a bull and a ram," I'll start in verse 3. "And the children of Israel, you shall say," speaking, so the Lord's telling Moses what to tell the people. And he says, "And to the children of Israel, you shall speak, saying, 'Take a kid of the goats as a sin offering, and a calf and a lamb, both of the first year, without blemish, as a burnt offering, also a bull and a ram as peace offerings to sacrifice before the Lord, and as a grain offering mixed with oil. For today the Lord will appear to you.'" So there it is. The Lord will appear to you. So it happens over there in verse 23. And how does it happen? It happens as the Lord appears to him, and also this fire consumes the burnt offering. Completely consumes it. What does that make you think of? What is that like? Anybody remember another time that happened?
Elijah,
Mount Carmel. Very good. And that was a trench around it, and water poured over the offering, over the wood, to fill the whole trench around there. And it consumed all that, including the water in the trench, consumed it all. Another miracle. This is Lord taking the burnt offering. In a display that look at the result from the people, in a display that they saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. And as a matter of fact, that's the same thing that the people did with Elijah. And it's 1 Kings 18. Yeah, let's go over there. 1 Kings 18, 38 and 39. First Kings 18, starting in 38. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust, and it licked up the water that was in the trench. Now when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, he is God, the Lord, he is God." So we have the same kind of response to seeing this, seeing the Lord take up the sacrifice, consume the sacrifice. All you can do is prostrate yourself in awe, right? And worship God, which is what the people did. And it's interesting that the Lord consumed the whole burnt offering and the fat on the altar. And then we get right into chapter 10, where we get the exact opposite of the obedience that we got in chapter 8 and chapter 9, right? This is where we get disobedience. So chapter 10, verses 1 and 2, then Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, the two oldest sons, each took his censer and put fire in it, put incense on it, and offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them. Verse 3, so fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. So we just saw the Lord consume the burnt offering. Then we see disobedience, somebody doing something what the Lord had not commanded, and they get consumed by his fire. Devoured. Do you guys have any different words in your translations for the profane fire before the Lord? Strange fire, I think I saw once. And unauthorized fire. Interesting. What version is that? English Standard. It certainly was unauthorized based on the way God responded to it. I think it all comes down to that next phrase, that which he had not commanded them. Right?
Well, that's what made it strange.
That's what made it strange. Unauthorized. Right? Because he had not commanded them to do that. I don't know exactly how he didn't command them to do it, but he didn't. If they had done what he had commanded, it would have been accepted, and they wouldn't have been devoured by the Lord.
Well, that's the thing. He told them what they should, where they should get their fire.
Right.
And they didn't get it from there.
So is where they got the fire from? Maybe the kind of incense that they had mixed? Maybe wasn't the authorized correct proportions of the different spices to make the incense?
Well, it seems to me that it's where they got the fire. It wasn't the incense itself. It was where they got the fire to burn the incense.
Incense. What is that? What is it, it? Everybody agree with Rex that it was the fire?
I think so.
Where did he command him to get the fire?
Out of the altar.
Which probably would have been started from when he consumed the whole offering right before this, right?
It was 24 hours.
Right, from that point on, they're supposed to keep it lit all the time.
I mean, as many sacrifices as were being made, they probably wanted to have more than 24 hours in their day so they could get it all taken care of.
Yeah. It was a full-time job for more than one person, wasn't it? The priestly duties were involved. It took a lot. to keep the incense burning on the inside the tabernacle, and to keep the altar burning, and to help people make their offerings of sacrifice. Sprinkling of blood, all those things. Yeah. Yep. So, what popped out to me about all of the commandments from God came from Deuteronomy 18, I believe it was. Is that where it was? Anyway, it read that God commanded them for their own good. So a commandment comes from God, it's always for our good. He's not commanding us to do something that's going to be bad for us. It's always for our good. So the Israelites were given all these commandments for their own good. And last week, Eric was trying to get across something that was hard for me to understand, but we talked about it afterwards, and I kind of started getting it a little bit more. When you first think of the word sacrifice, you think of giving up something. But in actuality, the sacrifices gained them something. It was good for them. It was to their benefit, not their cost. And to have that attitude is probably the best attitude to have about offering something to God, right? You're offering your best, the first fruits, right? And it's not I'm giving up my best stuff. It's I'm giving God my best stuff. I'm giving God the best of me, right? And I think that Rex was trying to touch on that last week too, with when he was talking about Cain and Abel. And I kind of looked at that a little bit more this week because of what he had said. And I kind of get the impression, have you ever noticed that it says that he gave fruits, but it doesn't say first fruits? It talks about, let's go over there, Genesis. What do I have? Genesis 4, verses 3 and 4. Genesis 4, verses 3 and 4 reads, "And in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was angry, and his countenance fell." I didn't notice that until I read it this week, that he offers his fruit, but he's not offering his first fruit. Every other time you talk about first fruit in the Bible, it's the best. It's the best offering, right? Fruit could have been the stuff that was going bad. Could have been stuff that was, I've had enough of that kind. So kind of, to me, in my mind, I started thinking, well, maybe that's part of the problem with Cain's offering. Where Abel gave his firstborn, he gave the best, the first, right?
Well, the firstlings of the flock always belonged to God.
Right.
They were all God.
And that is even before he made that claim to the Israelites, right? This is happening. Cain and Abel. We don't know of anything that was told to Adam or Cain or Abel about how they should offer, what they should offer. But we do know that later on, his firstborn was the requirement of the offering, right? It was a firstborn and a without blemish.
Well, but the offering of the firstborn, it's going to be required by the law. Talking about it earlier, all the different offerings that they have, and that really separate offering. Everyone that had a flock, the firstborn of the animals, the sheep and the goats and the cattle, belong to God.
Not only that, but the humans. He says they belong to me. All the firstborn belong to me.
Firstborn males.
Firstborn belongs to God. And the offerings, it was a requirement. At this point, by Leviticus, if you're offering an animal for sacrifice or an offering to God, any of them, they all have that firstborn requirement.
I don't think that's true.
Okay. Maybe it's not.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, every animal that was sacrificed couldn't have been a firstborn animal because they were sacrificing hundreds, if not thousands, of animals on a regular basis. But the firstborn was a specific sacrifice that had to be made.
The one that opened the womb.
Right.
Was the extra special one.
Talks about here, each of the animals has to be a year old.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk more about obedience versus disobedience. That's kind of where my study went. The first person that came to my mind was Jonah. Jonah, in Jonah chapter 1, why are you hiding? Jonah chapter 1, verse 3, it reads, "But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord." So in verse 1, it says, "Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, 'Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me.'" So that was the command from God to Jonah, to go to Nineveh. Did God say, don't go to Tarshish? Or don't go to Joppa? No. But the command was to go to Nineveh. So by him going to those other places, he's fleeing, it says, fleeing the presence of the Lord, right?
He's trying to.
He's trying to be disobedient to God, right? And what comes of it when he disobeys God in that sense? He doesn't go to Nineveh. He tries to avoid going to Nineveh. What happens to him? We know. Read a little bit further down in verse 7 and verse 10. He's on the ship now with these sailors and this captain, and they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots that we may know for whose cause this trouble has come upon us." So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. So they knew that Jonah was the cause of their trouble. Keep reading. "Then they said to him, 'Please tell us, for whose cause is this trouble upon us? What is your occupation, and where do you come from? What is your country, and of what people are you?' So he said to them, 'I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land.'" And verse 10, "Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, 'Why have you done this?' For the men knew that he fled from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. Then they said to him, 'What shall we do to you that the sea may be calm for us?' For the sea was growing more tempestuous. And he said to them, 'Pick me up and throw me into the sea, that the sea will become calm for you. For I know that this great tempest is because of me.'" So he told them he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord. And they like, that's what they, what are we going to do? What should we do then? Throw me overboard. And everything will get better for you guys. So he's coming around now. He's starting to obey the command. You know, he's like, well, I know I caused this problem because I'm fleeing from God, right? And he does end up going to Nineveh. So he does do the command. But at first, he's kind of rebelling, right? He's kind of disobeying, trying to do it his own way, right? And that's why it came to my mind about doing what the Lord commanded, because the Lord didn't specifically tell him not to do the things that he did, but he was trying to circumvent the commandment of the Lord, is the idea in my mind. He was trying not to do what he was commanded to do any way he could, or at least delay it. I mean, at least he had that in mind. Like, I'm not going directly there, right?
He wasn't planning on going there at all.
I don't think so at all either. I think you know, by this time when the storm's getting bad and these sailors are saying, "Is this because of you?" And, yeah, he's starting to click.
We understand Jonah knew what God was going to do, and he didn't want to have any part of that. He didn't want them forgiven.
He didn't want to go to Nineveh. Exactly, he didn't want to do what he was commanded to do by God. You're touching on exactly what I'm getting at. Just because he didn't want to do it doesn't mean that God didn't command it. And just because he didn't understand why it was good, because God's commandments are always for our good, right? So God commanding Jonah to do this is for our good, for Jonah's good as well.
Well, it certainly was for the Ninevites' good.
That's right. And I might not understand why it's good for me or good for us or good for anybody, but it's the commandment of the Lord. So it needs to be done, it needs to be obeyed, right? Even if I don't understand why. That's the idea. So that brought me to this thought that I had of Moses. So Moses was a pretty obedient guy, right? But the one time he didn't obey, it cost him going into the promised land. And what I really found out from this study was I always thought they were the same event, but I think they were two different events. Exodus 17, 1 through 7 was the first time. It was right when they got out of Egypt. So it's early in the Exodus and early in the travels, probably the first or second year. So Exodus 17, verses 1 through 7. It reads, "Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin according to the commandment of the Lord and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, 'Give us water that we may drink.' So Moses said to them, 'Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?' And the people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, 'Why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?' So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, 'What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it that the people may drink.' And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel." Okay, so we named the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel and because they tempted the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So this time, Moses was obedient about what God commanded him to do, to bring water out of a rock, basically, right? For the people, so they won't thirst. Now, let's go over to the second time this happens in Numbers. Chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20, verses 1 through 13. I believe this is 40 years later. I think this is near the end of their time wandering. And the reason I thought that was because I kind of looked forward in Numbers 33. In Numbers 33, the whole chapter, it kind of summarizes it reviews the time when they were in the wilderness, the 40 years they were in the wilderness. And you see both of these points in this reading. And the second point is near the end of the chapter. And it's totally separate from the first one where they were near Rephidim. Okay? So this is starting in verse 1. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin according to the commandment of the Lord and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." So Moses said to them, "Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?" Oh, I'm on the wrong one. That was the other one I read. Sorry. Yeah, Numbers 20. Sorry. Numbers 20 and verse 1. Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. And the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, "If only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord, why have you brought us the assembly of the Lord into the wilderness that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink." So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and they fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, gather the congregation together. Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation and their animals." So Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. So far, so good, right? And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, still obeying, still following the commandment. And he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" Uh-oh. Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. Yikes. And water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. So, right there, he disobeyed. He not only took the glory, but he didn't do it the way God told him to do it. He didn't tell him to strike the rock. He strokes the rock twice, kind of remembering, I'm thinking he's remembering the first time, and he struck the rock once that time, and this is the second time, so, right? What? And you're taking glory from God, saying that, why do we have to bring water for you, right? Why does God have to bring water for you? That's the question. But he didn't ask that. He asked we.
We must be Moses and Aaron.
Right? God still did what he told Moses he was going to do, was bring water. But what does he say next in verse 12? Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe me, did not follow my commandment, you did not hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, you hallowed yourself. Therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." As far as I can tell, this is the time Moses disobeyed with a little bit of arrogance and, right? Yeah, maybe he's frustrated because of the children of Israel, of course. I mean, this all over and over and over again. This is happening, you know, during this time, right? This 40 years we're wandering in the desert. They're constantly complaining. Where's the food? Where's the water? Why'd you bring us out of Egypt? We were comfortable there. You were slaves. You had just been told that you need to make more bricks with less. You have to go get your own straw, right, to make your bricks. And it was better off back there? Okay. So the contention, the complaints keep coming and coming from the Israelites. So yeah, I understand his frustration, but he disobeyed God's command here. And he gets a serious consequence for that, right? He's not allowed to go in. He gets to watch them go in, but he has to stay behind. Right? That's pretty big, I think. And it's basically because he disobeyed. He didn't get the earthly reward. I think he still got his rest. I still think he still got to the land of rest, but just not the earthly one. But this is a moment of disobedience from Moses. And I think of him as a pretty obedient, humble guy. And this is a moment of pride and disobedience, right? pretty telling. I also thought about the case of the Israelites under Joshua. In Joshua 7, you guys remember this one? Facing Ai. How do you say that city? Ai? Okay. Joshua 7. In verse 1, it says, "But the children of Israel committed a trespass regarding the accursed things. For Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed things. So the anger of the Lord burned against the children of Israel." Do you remember why it was accursed things? Remember why it was a trespass? They were commanded not to take that stuff, not to take anything. And he took some and buried it, right? And so what happens next? And in verses 6 through 9, that Joshua, they go against Ai and they get turned away. They lose. And then in verse 6, then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until evening, he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. So they're mourning. Like, why do we lose? And Joshua said, "Alas, Lord God, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? Oh, that we had been content and dwelt on the other side of the Jordan. Oh, Lord, what shall I say when Israel turns its back before the enemy? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear it and surround us and cut off our name from the earth. Then what will you do for your great name?" Right? I love the way the Lord answers them. So the Lord said to Joshua, "Get up. Why do you lie thus on your face? Israel has sinned, and they have also transgressed my covenant, which I commanded them. For they have even taken some of the accursed things and have both stolen and deceived, and they have also put it among their own stuff. Therefore, the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies, but turn their backs before their enemies, because they have become doomed to destruction. Neither will I be with you anymore unless you destroy the accursed from among you. Get up, sanctify the people, and say, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, because thus says the Lord God of Israel. There is an accursed thing in your midst, O Israel. You cannot stand before your enemies until you take away the accursed thing from among you." And then we find out that Joshua goes and finds the stuff, who did it, and he corrects it, right? But Joshua went right back to the same complaint. We disobeyed. Why did you bring us here? Right? You know, why you didn't let us win against Ai? Why? Complaint, right? That's right, there's sin. They did something that God did not command. He commanded them not to do it, and they did it, right? This is disobedience, right? And it has to be corrected. There has to be consequences for the disobedience, just like with Moses. He had consequences for his disobedience. Jonah had consequences for his disobedience. You know, I got to spend 3 days in the belly of a big fish, man. That doesn't sound fun to me. Let's talk about stench. I'm sure that would stink in there, right? I don't know. Just doesn't sound fun. Be tossed in the water. Maybe you're going to drown. Swallowed up by a big fish. Spit out. Disobedience. So another big time disobedience was mentioned in the scripture, the Old Testament, is with Saul, King Saul. In 1 Samuel 15, and I think I'll start with verse 10, because that sums it up right at the beginning. Verse 10, 1 Samuel 15, 10. "Now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, I greatly regret that I have set up Saul as king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. And then over in verse 17, starting in 17 through 23, I'll read that whole section. So Samuel said, "When you were little in your own eyes, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed.' Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord?" And Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal." Oh, good intentions. They took that stuff to sacrifice to the Lord? Oh. So Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is an iniquity and idolatry, because you have rejected the word of the Lord. He also has rejected you from being king." So Saul, this isn't the first time he disobeyed, but this is the basically the last time, last straw. God says in verse 10 that he's too many tries. I'm not gonna be behind him as king anymore. I'll reject him as king because he disobeyed. In that section in there, we're talking about burnt offerings in Leviticus. And what does it say? It says obeying the voice of the Lord is way more important than all those burnt offerings, those sacrifices. The problem is rebellion, disobedience, right? Huge one right there, huge consequences. So I'm going to get back to Leviticus, the chapter 10 that we were in. We just heard about the disobedience of Nadab and Abihu in the beginning of the chapter. And then they're devoured by the Lord. And then they're taken out by relatives. And then you read later in the chapter, and this I need your guys' help with this, because I don't quite understand it. I have some thoughts on it, but I want to get more of a sense of what's going on here. And I'm talking about the section from verse 16 through the end of the chapter. And I'll read it. "Then Moses made careful inquiry about the goat of the sin offering, and there it was burnt up. And he was angry with Eleazar and Ithamar." Those are the two younger sons of Aaron who are now doing the priestly duties with Aaron. "The sons of Aaron who were left, saying, 'Why have you not eaten the sin offering in a holy place, since it is most holy, and God has given it to you to bear the guilt of the congregation to make atonement for them before the Lord? See, its blood was not brought inside the holy place. Indeed, you should have eaten it in a holy place, as I commanded.' And Aaron said to Moses, 'Look, this day they have offered their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord, and such things have befallen me.'" I think he's talking about losing his two sons. "Such things have befallen me," right? "If I had eaten the sin offering today, would it have been accepted in the sight of the Lord?" So when Moses heard that, he was content. What's going on here? So obviously the command was to eat the portion for the priests of the goat, right? The sin offering, the goat of the sin offering. They were supposed to eat it in a holy place, right? But they didn't. The priest didn't eat it. And when Moses talks to him about it, what does Aaron say?
He says, "We've already eaten sin offerings today."
That's right. Are we supposed to keep eating for all these until we can't eat anymore?
Well, I think this latter sin offering is the sin offering for the people, not the sin offering
for the priests.
Which they ate. That's the interpretation I've always
heard. Okay. Excellent. That was one of my thoughts, that it's, they already ate the sin offering that was presented for them, for the priests. So they don't need to eat the sin offering that was presented for all the people. Right? Or they couldn't eat the sin offering that was offered for the people because they already ate. Right?
And nobody else could eat it except them.
That's right. And was it disobeying for them not eating it? That's the question. We're talking, there's obedience going on here, right? Disobedience and stuff like that going on here. So was it disobeying God by not eating their portion that was a part of the goat of the sin offering for the people? They burned it all up.
I mean, since they didn't get burned, well, God didn't burn them, so then there wasn't disobedience.
Okay. Obviously, there's something else going on because Moses is content from what Aaron tells him. What's going on there?
Well, number one, I think Moses gets really upset in verse 16 with Eleazar and Ithamar. Probably as a reflex, he just lost Nadab and Abihu because they were disobedient. Now he sees more disobedience. I think he might be kind of...
He doesn't want to lose more nephews.
He doesn't want to lose his other two.
Right.
So I think that...
I like that.
It seems to me that Aaron goes to Moses for an interpretation of the law.
Right here?
Yes.
For this part?
Yes. For the eating of the portion that is theirs of the sin offering. And nobody was killed by the Lord, so it must have been acceptable.
Mm-hmm. We have to assume that they were obedient because, like people have said, there was no repercussion like any other time somebody's disobedient, right? How that's obedient? I don't know. Maybe it's kind of like what Randy was saying. Maybe that portion was given to the priests, and once it's given to them, they can eat as much or as little as they want of it.
What was Christ's answer? Have you not read about David and his followers?
The showbread.
The showbread.
Mm-hmm. And nobody's authorized to eat that except the priest.
And it wasn't a sin.
That's right. That kind of gets to the New Testament ideas that I got about disobedience. Because you get to the New Testament, you start with Romans 11. Let's go to Romans 11. Verse 30 to 31. For as you were once disobedient to God, yet have now obtained mercy through their disobedience, even so these also have now been disobedient, that through the mercy shown you, they also may obtain mercy. So I know I'm disobedient. But here it's talking about God's mercy is greater than my disobedience.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. And sometimes my disobedience is bringing mercy to me and others. Through that disobedience, because I'm learning from it.
That doesn't mean you should continue to be disobedient.
Exactly. But my understanding of my disobedience allows me to understand God's mercy about it.
Well, it allows you to repent.
Yes, and put, yep, exactly. Godly repentance is 2 Corinthians 7, right? Godly sorrow, right? So Hebrews 4, verses 6, what does that one say? Anybody remember? Come on, I know you got it memorized. What? Hebrews 4, verse 6. Since therefore it remains that some must enter it, and those to whom it was first preached did not enter because of disobedience, again, he designates a certain day, saying in David, today, after such a long time, as it has been said, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. So, get this idea in Hebrews about the fact that the Israelites, in this time that we're talking about back in Leviticus, there's a lot of disobedience. And some of them were not allowed to enter. The first generation out of Exodus, out of Egypt, wasn't allowed to enter the promised land, the rest, as it was, right? Except for two. And who were the two? Joshua and Caleb, right? Because of their obedience, they got to go in. But everybody else, because of their disobedience, they did not enter.
Including Moses.
And Aaron. So this makes me think back to Luke 1, verses 17, where we get a little glimpse into why John was brought as Elijah to make straight the path of Jesus. And this little phrase popped out of me, Luke 1:17. It says, he will also go before him, that's John going before Jesus, in the spirit and power of Elijah, there it is, to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just, to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. So one of John's jobs was to turn the disobedient to the wisdom of the just. Do you ever feel like you were disobedient, maybe got turned to the wisdom of the just somewhere along the line, following your master and savior, Jesus? I know I have.
We've all been.
Right. Which, that's the whole idea, right? The obedience points to the perfect example of obedience, which is Jesus, right? So in John 15... Verses 9 through 17, Jesus says, As the Father loved me, I also have loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. The things I have spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father, I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he may give you. These things I command you, that you love one another. Back the chapter before in chapter 14 and verse 31, this is the perfect example of Jesus. What does he say there? He says, but that the world may know that I love the Father, and as the Father gave me command, so I do. As the Father gave me commandment, so I do. There it is. God commanded it. We do it, right? That's obedience. Any thoughts, questions, concerns? Criticisms? Critiques? What's your assignment for next week? Next week, what's that?
Read some more,
that's right. I think next week I'm going to focus on atonement and blood. So it's most important to read the middle two chapters, 16 and 17, I believe they are. Let me make sure. Yes, 16 and 17. Read 11 through 17. How about that? But pay particular attention to 16 and 17 because that's going to be my primary focus next week. All right. Thank you.